From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Peter Bryant, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick today. Coming up, we'll feature an interview Terry recorded with Tipper Gore. As a founder of the Parents Music Resource Center, Gore wants records with sexually explicit lyrics to carry warning labels. Her critics say that's censorship. Also today, photographer Bruce Davidson talks about his latest book, pictures of the people who commute on or live in the New York subways. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward will take a look at the erratic career of Louisiana swamp rocker Tommy McLean. And our book critic John Leonard reviews The Fortune Teller, the first novel from Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Marsha Norman. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
With me now on Fresh Air is Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center, whose aim is to alert parents to music that the group thinks could be harmful to children and teenagers. The group is pressuring the music industry to put warning labels on records with sexually explicit or violent lyrics. The focus of her efforts has been heavy metal and punk groups, whose lyrics, she argues, glamorize suicide, rape, and sadomasochism. But she has also criticized mainstream acts like Prince and Madonna for the provocative nature of their music and stage shows. Gore's concerns were fully aired at highly publicized hearings on Capitol Hill 2 years ago that pitted her against such disparate musicians as Frank Zappa and John Denver. Tipper Gore has written a new book. It's titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. It takes on not only the record industry, but also music videos and violent TV shows. Tipper Gore's husband is Tennessee Senator Albert Gore, who recently declared his candidacy for the Democratic presidential nomination. Tipper Gore, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. I'm glad to be here.
Now, how did you first become aware of sexually explicit lyrics in music?
Because my children tuned me in. I grew up with rock music in the 60s. I like rock music. I like all kinds of music. And I was a bit surprised to find out how graphically some of the content has changed in recent years. My oldest daughter is now 13. When she was 11, we went together and bought Prince's Purple Rain album, along with 14 million other people. I think he's a musical genius. I had liked a lot of the songs I'd heard on the radio, and she was very interested in him. I didn't know that he'd had a history of sexually explicit albums, which in fact he had at the time. I just knew he was the new pop idol, and she wanted his songs. So we bought it. And our first indication was when we played on the family stereo a song called Darling Nikki, which did describe a girl masturbating in a hotel lobby. Now, that tuned me into how things had changed.
I want to just play the beginning of that record so our listeners could get a sense of what you were listening to. So this is Prince.
I guess you could say she was a sex fiend. I met her in a hotel lobby, masturbating with a magazine. She said, how'd you like to waste some time? And I could not resist when I saw little Nikki grind.
So that's an example of the record that you were listening to. And there's the word masturbating. Masturbating with a magazine is the line in it.
Well, masturbating with a magazine, watching little Nikki grind, it goes on to more graphic descriptions. I mean, I just thought that it was a bit much for my 11-year-old. What really made me angry was that I hadn't known beforehand.
Well, did your daughter know what masturbating meant?
Well, she was listening to the record with her friend, and I think that yes, they understood what that meant. The issue is not what I think or what she thinks of quote-unquote, those kinds of issues. What this meant to me and why I cite it was that was the first indication I'd had that the lyrics had indeed taken a very graphic turn.
And you were upset about that. So what, did you
mainly
make rules
because,
in your house about rock records after that?
Well, we talked about it. I mean, I put the record on a higher shelf. She also has younger sisters. We talked about it. I advocate communication between parents and children, particularly about sexuality. The point is a subtle one, but I would not have particularly bought that album for her at that age had I known it was that explicit. I think that is individual parenting rights, and other people might feel very, very differently.
So let's talk about the kind of rules you created in your house after you realized that rock lyrics had become much more sexually explicit than they used to be. You started putting that on the top shelf. What else did you do?
Well, also violent. I mean, probably what disturbs me more than anything is the glorification of violence in the lyrics, the degradation of women. In looking into this, I saw some videos by groups that were very popular with young teens. They show scantily clad women rounded up with men with whips put into cages. It obviously has sexual overtones that are menacing. I mean, David Lee Roth has said that sadomasochism is something that's commercialized to teens now, and in some cases, preteens.
But I want to hear what you did in your house.
In my house, we discussed it. I sat down and watched MTV with my children. I was allowing them to watch it at will. Ironically, I would be monitoring the television shows they saw. I didn't want them to see too much violence on primetime TV. I've been concerned about that for years. I didn't know I needed to monitor the music. And in addition to many innovative, creative videos, there were also some that had very graphic splices of violence thrown up there very rapidly and some explicitly sexual images. Now, my children then were 6, 8, and 11. So I said, well, you can't just watch this all the time. Now I'm going to watch it with you. We're going to talk about it. I really didn't want them to see. Some of the images did frighten them, quite frankly. And it's no different than what they might see in a TV show or a movie.
Now, what are the groups that you found to be the most offensive in rock music?
Well, again, it's not that I have a particular list and I want to say, look, I think these are good and I think these are bad. I really am trying to alert people to tune in to the music, to the entertainment that their children are attracted to, and use it as a tool to communicate with the child. Listen to the child. Why does the child like this? Are there things in here that the parents should be concerned about? It's not up for me to say. What I advocate is information, people being more tuned in, and information from the record company so people can make up their own minds, and that's going to vary.
You know, I, like you, grew up with rock and roll, and I don't remember rock and roll ever being a tool for communicating between parents and children. It was, in my household, it was just the opposite. When the kids wanted to get away from the parents, that's where rock and roll came in. It was never something to, like, you know, bridge the gap or to sit down and discuss.
But you didn't have the kinds of themes in the rock and roll then that you have now. There weren't songs about sadism, about thrill killing, about suicide, about raping a woman, about forcing a woman sexually, about forcing oral sex on a young woman by a group that's very popular with preteens and young adolescents that has sold 2 million copies. I mean, this is a very graphic change, and that's why I think that parents really need to tune in today. It has changed, and while there's tremendous, just fun songs, there are these that are mixed in that maybe parents ought to be aware of.
It's true that the lyrics weren't nearly as explicit, 10, 20, 25 years ago. But on the other hand, people were as frightened by rock and roll. For instance, you know, when Elvis Presley was on the Ed Sullivan Show, the camera wasn't allowed to show his gyrating pelvis. When the Beatles and the Rolling Stones came to America, parents were in an uproar that their children were going to be corrupted and perverted by these, you know, shaggy-haired, strange people from another country who are singing rock and roll.
I think there's a big difference between Elvis's swiveling hips and a chainsaw blade between the thighs of Blackie Lawless, lead singer of a group called Wasp. The fact that they use a half-naked woman chained to a torture rack and they pretend to slit her throat in concert act, I'd say that is a qualitative difference. And I think parents ought to be tuned in. There's a group called Lizzie Borden. Their stage act consists of a very erotically clad woman. They try to kiss her. She rebuffs them. Their answer is to hack her to death with an axe. Of course, this is simulated. Then they spit out the blood. I mean, this is very, very different fare. It's not that I think rock and roll music is going to bring down the Republic. I'm not frightened about it. I personally am outraged by an exploitation of preteens and young teenagers by companies that are marketing the bottom line of explicit sex and violence. I call it cultural strip mining. They don't ask, what is the impact? What are the scars? How are some of the kids coping with this? They take the money and they run. It's a commercial enterprise. It's backed with advertising, by executives strategically planning and thinking. And who's the audience? Younger and younger kids.
Now, you are working not only as an individual mother in your family, but you've co-organized a group called the Parents Music Resource Center that's petitioning for several things, including the labeling of records so that if they're sexually explicit or violently explicit material in the lyrics, it would be so labeled. You want to have all the lyrics available to a consumer before they purchase the record, and you also want to create a panel to set up policy guidelines for records.
No. Okay, the last is wrong. You've got it pretty well right, and there was a lot of publicity as our group debated and talked with the recording industry. First of all, 20 companies in the recording industry did agree to put a parental warning label that says explicit lyrics, parental advisory on the back of albums, or print the lyrics. They make the decision when they're you've got that right. That's correct. There's no panel. They make the decision. It's an issue of corporate responsibility. Also, the Parents Music Resource Center is in a coalition with the National PTA and the American Academy of Pediatrics. Both groups are, of course, oriented to child welfare. And also, they're interested in consumer information and creating awareness about the changes in some of today's entertainment medium.
For whose benefit are the warning labels?
The parents.
When do parents, I just don't know of a lot of parents who do the rock and roll shopping for their teenagers.
Well, I do. I mean, a lot of people still take their children to record stores if their children can't drive, if they don't live in the city.
Don't they kind of like drop them off, though,
sure.
Let the children shop?
Some of them do, and some of them probably don't. I mean, I don't. Let me tell you how this issue originally came up, and even the concept of printing the lyrics, through the National PTA at their 1984 convention, which represented parents and teachers in every state in the union. And one of the resolutions they passed, because it was of such concern, was this one, asking record companies to rate records. Now, later on, the agreement that we came up with the recording industry is not a record rating. It's just, a warning or putting the lyrics out there. The reason is, and we debated all this, is because we felt like we have a problem with the increasing explicitness and violence that's commercially marketed to younger and younger kids. And we're talking about even elementary-aged kids that are now tuned in. And we thought the only way in our free society to address it is by putting it on the table, so to speak, putting a little more light on it. We are not advocating censoring or banning or that it shouldn't be there. But in the words of Thomas Jefferson, the way to address excesses in free speech is through more speech, hence print the lyrics. Bring it out to the light of day. Hopefully you'd teach older kids to make their own decisions, maybe based on this kind of information.
There's something very potentially ironic about printing explicit lyrics and making them available before you've even purchased the record. We all know that in so many rock and roll songs, and this is historically true in rock and roll, you can't make out the lyrics. You know, one of the things parents used to traditionally complain about is, I don't know how you can listen to those songs. Who can understand the lyrics? So isn't it almost counterproductive for you to have the lyrics written out?
Well, I don't think so. I would ask your listeners to think about the song they just heard. I think the lyrics were very distinct.
But Prince isn't into heavy metal. I mean, it's different than the typical song that you're worried about.
Well, I would also like to point out that now many of the songs, particularly heavy metal songs, have accompanying videos with very powerful images. And it's easy for a young child to go right from Sesame Street to tune in to MTV or the broadcast channels of rock videos. Very powerful images. And in some cases, they even change the interpretation of a song. They seem to be using the sex and violence to sell, where if you just heard the song, you might interpret it differently yourself.
You've used the example that you want to fight some speech with more speech, and by printing the lyrics and having warning labels on. In the record industry, it's being largely perceived as having a chilling effect, that would have a chilling effect on speech within music.
Why did the record industry agree to this voluntary program?
Because of all the pressure being put on them, I think. Isn't that what they've said? Isn't that what their spokespeople have said?
Their official statement is that it's a legitimate consumer complaint. They probably pulled out their files from a couple years ago when the National PTA was writing to them, trying to get them to address this issue.
A friend of mine is fond of saying that the ratings in movies nowadays exist more for parents than for younger people. And I think that this is true of people of our generation, for instance. We're both in our 30s, yes?
Yes.
And I know people of my age, when we take our parents to the movies, we wonder, is there going to be language in this film that will be offensive to them? Will will my parents be offended if there's a sex scene in the movie? And so a lot of people think that the ratings nowadays are for people in their 60s and 70s more so than for younger people or for even teenagers. Do you know what I'm saying? That every generation seems to have a different standard of what is acceptable and what is really offensive.
And that's exactly what this whole discussion is about, is what are the limits in the public domain, particularly where children are concerned. And I think they've changed. Could I just talk a little bit about concert performances?
Sure.
I don't want to stay on music entirely because the book is about, you know, TV and movies and with particular emphasis on violence. But in the context of people not knowing, the average age of a fan of a group, particularly of a group like the Beastie Boys, according to them in Newsweek magazine, are 13-year-old girls. And what do they do in their concert act? Well, I quote from the Washington Post, quote, "This band performed sexual acts on stage at a recent concert in Columbus, Ohio. The members of this rock band reportedly took turns kissing the naked breast of the crafty girl in the cage, a bikini-clad girl dancing in a cage." It goes on. Their lyrics refer to angel dust and crack with lines like, "I trust that crack." In Memphis, the Beastie Boys used a giant inflatable penis during their song "Fight for Your Right" in Columbus, Georgia. They invited girls from the audience to bare their breasts and have sex with members of their road crew. It goes on. My point is, people ought to be informed in the public domain if an act is going to be this explicit. We're going to vary in our personal opinions as to whether this is acceptable or not. But there were kids 7, 8, 9 in the audience for this act whose parents were outraged because they weren't informed beforehand.
I want to talk more about this in a second. We're going to take a short break. My guest is Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center. We'll be back in a second. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Tipper Gore. She co-founded the Parents Music Resource Center, whose goal is to alert parents to music with explicit sexual or violent lyrics. She wants the music industry to put warning labels on such records. Tipper Gore has written a new book titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. Now, you were just talking about the stage acts that a lot of rock groups have.
That some of them have.
Now, some of the heavy metal and punk groups are really into irony, and with some of them, it's hard to tell whether you should be taking something at face value or taking them on an ironic level.
Well, something like I just read. Is that ironic, what I just read?
With the Beastie Boys, I'd say there's a good chance what they were doing had an ironic level to it.
Yeah, but I mean, going over and kissing the naked breast of the girl in the cage, lyrics about crack, I mean, a giant inflatable penis. I mean, where's the irony? There could be irony for older people, but can a 9-year-old, can a 7-year-old, you know, are they going to pick up on that?
You know what I'm wondering? You know how rock and roll has always had a certain shock value and also has been about rebellion? You know how rock and roll has always been associated with rebellion for children?
Sure.
And for teenagers?
Sure.
Do you think that your attempts to crack down in a way?
No, I simply want to make parents aware.
Okay, but you want parents to
do whatever they feel is appropriate in their own homes with their kids.
Okay, and do you think that is, in its own way, creating a backlash of even more explicit and violent and just really flamboyant stage acts and lyrics in defiance of the kind of work your group is doing?
This kind of thing has been happening, and I'd like to point to the fact that it really is kind of cultural strip mining. These are marketing decisions, okay? Look, here is an ad which is described in the book. I know your listeners can't see it, but it's an ad from movie producers to television programmers in something called electronic media. The general public is not going to see it. But what do they say? Boost the ratings with your teen viewers with these 16 exploitation films. Exploitation films, that's explicit sex and violence. I mean, it's a marketing decision. So that's why we're seeing so much of it. I mean, it gets into a kind of competitive titillation. But again, I think the issue is, what is the sensitivity to younger kids in these audiences? It's up to parents to set rules, make guidelines, talk with their kids, and talk about these issues, but I think parents have not been particularly tuned in to the changes, like I wasn't, because I didn't have to worry about this. This stuff wasn't this graphic when I was growing up.
How do your children feel about your activism?
I hope it sets a good example for them. I mean, I want the message to be, we are responsible for the society we're creating. You are responsible, no matter what issue it is you want to get involved in, whether it's, you know, raising awareness about the homeless or child abuse or whatever it is, take action on your beliefs.
I guess I want to know if they resent the amount of control you want to exert, or if they're, I guess I'd even like to know if their friends, if their peers make fun of them at all, because you're in such, because you're in the limelight, and because you're asking parents to monitor their children. It's not something that teenagers usually go for.
Of course not. I mean, teenagers are always testing the limit, and a rebellion is a natural stage of development, and it's a natural part, as you say, of rock and roll and other things. I'm talking about exploitation to the excess, what I think is, and I'm trying to tell people, make up your own minds about it, but at least take a good look at it, because it's a subculture that's developed to the kids, and basically adults are on their own wavelength. They're listening to their own music. They've been through this, and I think they make the mistake of figuring their kids can handle all this without any kind of input from them. So what I'm trying to say is take a look at it. My kids have handled it very well, to answer your question. I mean, they understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. I am fairly flexible. I am not this inflexible person that perhaps I appear to be.
What do you do when they want to go to a concert? Say they want to go to the Beastie Boys concert. What are you going to tell them?
I fortunately have really not had to deal with that yet, because my child is just 13. But I say that what parents ought to do is take a good look at these groups, find out what kind of stage acts they perform, find out what kind of lyrics, make your own decision if you think it's appropriate or not for your young child. That's my message. It's not that I'm trying to say this group is good, this group is bad, you shouldn't let your kids go, or you should. I think that's up to the individual parents and the kids. What I am saying is, look how graphically some of the content has changed, and get involved and make some of those decisions and help your kids make them.
What's the toughest thing that's happened in your family with your children in terms of them wanting to play a record or read a book or see a movie, you know, that you didn't want them to do?
Oh, I think just sort of the constant having to monitor things and look into things. If my child wants to see a movie and it's R-rated, we have a general rule, no R-rated movies, with the exception that sometimes we'll make exceptions. And I've even taken my oldest to an R-rated movie when it was just for language, and I knew she could handle that. So, you see, she knows that I'm flexible. She knows how I feel, but she also knows that I'm inflexible. So we talk about each thing. I also know that she's probably going to see some at a friend's house, etc. But at least there's a value put on violence. I mean, she thinks about it and the degradation of women. And it's not that I think that I'm going to protect her from this forever or control it down to the nth degree. It's just that I think what we've had up till now is a society that says, if it feels good, do it. If you want it, grab it. They don't think about the consequences. I think that's a little unhealthy for the kids. It's like, it's better to give them a rule to break than no rule at all.
You've been on a lot of panels, mm-hmm. with people, with musicians from the rock world, mm-hmm. Including Frank Zappa, who's been, I think, on a lot of panels with you.
Right.
What are those like for you? Here you are with people who are from the kind of type of music that you oppose. What's your reaction been like?
Well, it's always been very stimulating and very interesting. I think sometimes it's been unfair in that they have continued to say, oh, this woman wants to ban rock and roll, and I keep saying, look, I don't, not at all. I like it. It's just awareness.
You complain in your book that you think some of the musicians treat you in a sexist way, in the way they talk to you.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that perhaps they're not aware. I mean, one of the things I talk about is the degradation of women, the brutalization of women in some of the images, in some of the lyrics, in some of the promotional pictures, etc., trying to get people to think about it. Men have never been particularly sexually discriminated against. It's perhaps hard for them to understand why it's upsetting to women to see this kind of attitude continue to be glamorized and promoted to another generation of kids.
You don't like being called like a group of housewives or a group of senators' wives?
Well, names don't bother me. I learned early on, you know, don't worry about what names people call you. Try to focus on the issues. What I'm more concerned about is the sexist way women are portrayed as sex objects, as victims, even in television. Television right now has violence at an all-time high, with women usually portrayed as the victims. It's the same that you find in the music. This is from George Gribner, the University of Pennsylvania, who's tracked this. I mean, is this the kind of attitude we want to continue perpetrating in our society?
Your husband, who is Senator Albuquerque, recently announced his candidacy for the presidential Democratic nomination. Say he was elected. Would you, as First Lady, make this a big campaign nationally?
That's an interesting question. Most people don't realize how many issues I'm involved in. I'm on the board of an Alzheimer's daycare center. I'm on the board of the National Mental Health Association. I would like to draw attention to mental health. I'm working on a project to document homelessness in America that I started 2 years ago that I'm very excited about. I think we need to tackle the problem of homelessness.
Yeah, but would
in
you
this
continue
country.
This stuff?
It's
you don't know.
I'm not trying to dodge it. I'm trying to say that that position gives you a platform to focus on a lot of extremely important issues and problems in our nation, and I don't know what I would want to focus on, but there are many other things that I'm already involved in.
It's interesting. When I was reading your book, you print a lot of the most explicit lyrics in songs, and you reproduce photographs from some of the most graphic album covers and also very graphically violent or sexual shots from certain teen movies. And then I noticed on the cover of your book, there's an advisory. It says, warning, explicit material, parental advisory. Mm-hmm. Do you think parents who are reading your book should hide it from their children?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's up to the parent in their home to decide. They may want to talk about it. It depends on the age of the child, the involvement that the child has in the media. My whole point is, look, this is aimed at parents and adults. Most of the material that I talk about in here is the material that is aimed and marketed at the kids. The point being, the kids know all about this already. It's basically the parents that are not aware, and I'm trying to get them to focus. As to what they do in their own home, that's up to them.
Have your children read your book?
No, they have not.
I think a lot of our listeners would be interested in hearing what kind of music you grew up with.
I think I was 14 years old when the Beatles hit. I was too young, really, for Elvis Presley. I went crazy over the Beatles and the Dave Clark Five, the British Invasion, all of that music, Bob Dylan, folk music, Peter, Paul, and Mary. What I remember most about the music is it made you feel positive. It made you feel
Dylan
like
made you feel positive?
Well, what I mean in general about the music of the 60s, it was more message music that made you feel like you were part of a larger whole and that you could do something about problems. You know what I'm saying?
Did your parents ever warn you away from the music?
They didn't have to.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't think there wasn't the explicit sex or violence in the music that would have disturbed them. If they had a look at the kind of scene that's available today, in addition to all the good music that's out there, they might have warned me, yes. So but it wasn't necessary then.
You never warned by parents or teachers about rock and roll? Did you ever?
Oh, no. Uh-huh. Why would I? I mean, rock and roll, look, rock and roll is mainstream American music right now. But there's a part of it that's just being commercially exploited to kids, just like in other areas, whether it's TV or movies or some of the ads.
You're going to be stepping up your campaign against the music industry, you know, to have them label
lyrics. Actually,
what's the next step for your group?
Let me just say, the campaign, again, it's not really, I don't like to characterize a campaign against the music industry. It's a dialogue with the music industry.
We only have a couple of seconds.
Okay. They've agreed to voluntarily put lyrics on. Okay. That's great. It's a start. That's all. That's what we asked.
Tipper Gore, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Tipper Gore. She's co-founder of the Parents Music Resource Center. She's written a new book. It's titled Raising PG Kids in an X-Rated Society. This is Fresh Air.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional funds from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. ¶¶ From Philadelphia, I'm Peter Bryant with Fresh Air. Terry Gross is out sick today. Coming up, photographer Bruce Davidson talks about his year-long adventure on the New York City subway. The pictures of his fellow riders are gathered in his latest book of photographs. Also, rock historian Ed Ward travels the back roads of Louisiana in search of swamp rocker Tommy McLean. Book critic John Leonard reviews The Fortune Teller, playwright Marcia Norman's novel of abortion, kidnapping, and the occult. And we'll have a news update from NPR. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Time for the news. This is Fresh Air. Many of us have favorite singers who made it big with one hit and then disappeared. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has been lucky enough to track down one of his favorite one-hit country singers, Tommy McLean.
Sometimes a song can stop you dead in your tracks. When you think about it, though, it's more than the song. It's the performance, the sound of the thing, and whatever is going on in your life that makes you vulnerable to its making a place in your heart and mind and staying there. I can't remember what was going on for me in 1966 when I first heard Tommy McLean's version of the Don Gibson song, Sweet Dreams, the one Patsy Cline had made famous a few years earlier, but it sure got to me.
Sweet, sweet.
Extreme record. Tommy has an extreme voice, one with a lot of power but not a lot of control, and the recording is so bad that it's custom made for picking up on a poorly tuned car radio at night, which is almost certainly where I heard it first. But like all hits, it faded, and so did Tommy McLean's name. About 10 years later, I started picking up records from the amazing regional scene that had flourished in central Louisiana in the 60s, and discovered, much to my surprise, that Tommy McLean was part of it, right along with people like Clint West and the Boogie Kings, and Rod Bernard, and Cookie and the Cupcakes. If anything, he sounded better to me in 1976 than he had in 1966. And I wasn't alone. The British were paying attention, which is maybe why Elvis Costello's arrangement of Sweet Dreams on his Almost Blue album is so close to Tommy's. But what had happened to Tommy McLean? One day I found myself talking to Huey P. Moe, the Houston-based record producer who calls himself the Crazy Cajun. We'd been talking about his success with Freddie Fender. "The voice," Huey said. "I always look for the voice." So of course he knew Tommy McLean. Why, he'd recorded Huey's song, Think It Over. But aside from a cameo in the film The Drowning Pool, Huey didn't know where he was. Look, he said, he makes $6,000-$7,000 a month just playing the circuit in Louisiana. He don't need to make records. I made do with a greatest hits album I found and figured I'd never find him. But just before Mardi Gras, 1982, I was driving through Breaux Bridge, Louisiana, when I saw a sign announcing that Tommy McLean and the Mule Train Band was playing at a ramshackle bar that evening. I wasn't expecting much when I paid my $3, and I sure wasn't expecting what I saw on stage. A tiny gray-haired man with hair as long as Willie Nelson's and a ridiculously large cowboy hat was playing bass left-handed and leading a motley assemblage of musicians through a current country hit sung by a woman with a tambourine in her hand. But when he walked up to the mic and began singing the next song, there was no doubt about it. That was Tommy McLean, and he was sounding fantastic. I asked if he still did Sweet Dreams. Oh, sure, he said. We got to do that. And he didn't even mind singing it for the umpteenth time either. No, man, he told me the next day, that song got me where I am today. Took me all the way up and all the way down again, and I'm still singing it. It was a familiar enough tale. He'd pressed up 500 copies of an audition tape of him singing the song and sold them around Alexandria, where he was from. Gin Records, the big label in those parts, tried to find him, only to discover that he was playing bass with the Boogie Kings, whom they had under contract. So at the Boogie Kings' next session, the popular show band backed him as he poured out his soul. The record took off. The young man's ego got the better of him. The dope and drinking got out of hand. Well, familiar story, all right. But here's the good news. 2.5 months ago, I saw Tommy again, in the lounge at the Best Western in Lafayette. Not only was his voice still great, at least on the down-home material, but he's making records with Huey Moe. A medley of old favorites, a country song, trying once again.
I'll change my style.
He doesn't have to change his style. He's playing tonight in Lafayette, and the crowds love him. As for fame and fortune, well, he's been there. But at least Tommy McLean is still with us.
Ed Ward's comments on rock history are a regular feature of our show. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle and is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. This is Fresh Air. Every day, more than 2 million New Yorkers ride the subways. For many, it's the fastest, cheapest, yet most menacing way to get from one part of the city to another. One of these regular riders is photographer Bruce Davidson. In 1980, he spent the year photographing the daily life of the city's underground transit system. What emerged is a collection of photographs called Subway. Davidson told Terry Gross that, for him, the subway became more than a means of transportation.
It became kind of a metaphor for me. I found that the subway, with its graffiti, with its violence, with its metallic fluorescent glow, with its underground reality, that it had something to say about today, about the way we live, way we live in kind of a crumbling, terrorized world.
What was your routine like when you were traveling the subways to photograph them?
Typically, what I did over the year that I photographed in the subway was to ride the subway 8-10 hours a day without a destination. I would explore all the lines to the end of the line, sometimes riding the subway at 2 in the morning from one end to the other.
A lot of muggers work the subways, and with your camera equipment, you'd really make a great target. Did you do anything to make yourself seem less vulnerable?
Well, the way I worked in the subway was, and the way I always work, or at least I try to work, is with the camera open, exposed. Of course, I'm targeted for muggers or robbers or other people in the subway, but I felt that if I made contact, eye-to-eye contact with people, and I might have a chance of mugging them before they mugged me.
Mugging them? You mean like
mugging them with
them?
My camera in a kind of a mugshot. Later, I found out that the undercover detectives in the police, and there are quite a number of them, got word back to headquarters that this kind of new kind of hustler was on the subway that they've never seen before. And they've seen guys with bongo drums and guys with doing all kinds of, hustles on the subway. But they had never seen anyone making photographs before. And that sort of came back to headquarters, and they couldn't make any sense out of it.
So you became one of the characters who ride the subways all the time.
Yes, another queer.
There are some real characters on the subways. The last time I was on the New York subways, someone came in who really smelled of urine, and he said, "I am a homeless person. I do not have a home like you do." This was an announcement he was making to everyone in the car. He said, "I don't have a home like you do. I am living off of the generosity of a friend who is poor. If you do not help me now and give me some money, I will be forced to turn to a life of crime." And of course, you get the message there that if you don't offer this guy a dollar or whatever, by tomorrow he'll be a mugger. Have you met him? I have a feeling he works the subways a lot.
I've seen a lot of men smelling of urine, and most of them like to sit down between beautifully dressed women and watch their expressions. Everything goes in the subway, but there's another part of the subway that I'm interested in. There's a certain beauty in the subway, a certain theater. Sometimes you're in a subway car and you feel very close to everybody in the subway. I think a great love affair could be made in a subway.
A lot of people on the New York subways just stare at each other, and the way that the seats are arranged, they're long seats, bench-like seats, that just line the length of the subway. So you sit facing the people opposite you, and the hobby of people who ride the subways is just to stare at the other people. Now, the trick is to not let on that you're staring, because a lot of people are very insulted if they find out that you're staring at them. What you're doing is not only staring, but you're staring through a camera and taking their photograph. Did a lot of people get angry with you, hostile with you, because you wanted to photograph them?
No. During the year I was on the subway, I had very few situations where people were hostile towards me. First of all, I carried the camera open. Second of all, about a third of the time I approached someone with this camera open, and I asked them if I could make a photograph. I enjoyed the mood that they were in. Would they go back into it? And they either would say yes or no. If they hesitated, I brought out my album. I had a small wedding album full of my subway pictures, and I showed it to them. If they said no, then it was no forever. If they said yes, then I would go back and photograph them.
For me, the most distressing photo in your album is a photograph of a homeless, gray-haired woman. Her hair is really matted. She's standing alone in a subway car, picking up her soiled house dress and exposing herself, and she's naked underneath the dress. And off to her side is a mess of squished-up food that seems mixed in with old clothes, maybe even underwear, and what looks to be a couple of shoes. What's the story behind that photo?
This woman came into the train at about 3 o'clock in the morning. It was an empty train. I was on my way home. I had been photographing actually some naked men who were living in the subway, and this woman in this empty car began to undress and out of a bag made this vomitous mess in the middle of the floor of crushed strawberries and cornflakes and soiled clothing and whatnot. And I asked her if I could make a photograph of her. And she didn't say no, and I lifted my camera and made a flash. And then I'd made another flash, and she lifted her dress. Just as she lifted her dress and exposed her somewhat naked body, three youths charged into the train from another car, seeing my flash, and they looked at me with my expensive camera and flash, and they looked at her, and then they looked at this mess on the floor, and one of them said, "Hey, man, let's get out of here." She threw up all over the train. So I learned something from the situation, that this mess that she was making on the floor was a bonfire to ward off the wild animals, the beasts, because that time of night, young people in the subway are looking to rob other people very often, and wolf packs.
That's pretty ironic in a way that three teenagers who might have been muggers after your expensive equipment would be scared away from a mess to them that looked like vomit.
It would be, but I think that the sight of her lifting her dress, the sight of the vomit, and my camera going off, flash going off, was too much for them, and they ran away.
Too crazy even for them.
Even too crazy for them.
In your book, you wrote that your wife said that you weren't going to stop photographing in the subways until you were mugged. Well, you were mugged after a while. What happened?
Well, what happened was my family was away. It was a hot July day. I was riding the subway. It was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I was deep in Brooklyn. I was bored. I wanted to be with my family, and I turned my back on a couple of youths that I had approached and sort of forgot my presence, and they took advantage of it, and the two of them jumped me. I broke all the rules. I was in the end car. I wasn't aware. I was a sitting duck. I think I probably wanted to get mugged. I felt it was maybe my dues, you know. But I had one camera left. They only managed to get one in the struggle. And I continued that day photographing slowly. I was afraid of everybody, you know. But slowly I began to photograph. And I went on for a couple months after that working.
You're officially completed with your subway series now. Do you take taxis now, or do you still ride the subways?
No, I still ride the subways. It's not a state of mind. I'm not possessed by the subway any longer. It was an obsession. I could hear it rumbling below my windows at night, and I would get out of bed sometimes and get dressed and enter the subway like some sort of werewolf. It had a calling, just the sound of the steel wheels on the tracks would call me in.
Are you glad to be through with that?
I'm glad to be through with the tension in the subway. I'm on to other things. I may work on landscapes. I'm thinking about doing a number of things. But my work doesn't come from just a good idea. It comes from some state of mind, some need within myself that compels me to come close to subject matter, because I spend a long time with whatever I do. So it has to have some real meaning for me to sustain that effort.
Bruce, thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Terry.
Bruce Davidson's new book of photographs is called Subway. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of the news on today's All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the show, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hello, Peter.
Well, of course, the big story today is the continuing news about the attack on the USS Stark.
Yes, indeed. And in the aftermath of that attack, we have several stories. I spoke with a correspondent for the London Observer who described how the crippled ship is slowly making its way back to Bahrain, a huge hole ripped out of its side. We will also report on why our ships are in the Persian Gulf, what we hope to accomplish there.
Okay, what else is coming up today?
Well, we'll take what is really a rare tour of the Yale Audio Archives. That's one of the finest collections in the world, and it dates back 100 years.
All right, thanks, Renee. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered. 4 years ago, playwright Marcia Norman received the Pulitzer Prize for her play Night Mother. It was about a mother who tries unsuccessfully to stop her daughter from committing suicide. Norman then wrote the screenplay for Night Mother, and now she's written her first novel. It's called The Fortune Teller and is published by Random House. Our book critic, John Leonard, says Norman has once again produced a riveting work.
Marcia Norman seems to think she can do whatever she wants without much bother. She writes plays like Night Mother and wins prizes like the Pulitzer almost effortlessly. She decides to write a novel, and The Fortune Teller is her first, and it's at once ingratiating and scary. And yet it seems as if she's never read any other novel. Nobody ever told her that there were lots of novelists out there, dead and alive, who had grappled with and sometimes solved certain technical problems, like point of view and plausibility and pacing. Marcia Norman just makes it up as she goes along, sort of like Grandma Moses, but also like Henri Rousseau. Primitive, but in the end it tears you apart. What The Fortune Teller is mostly about is abortion. 27 children in a medium-sized American town are kidnapped from a circus and held for ransom. Unless the town agrees to oppose abortion by any means possible, the kidnapped children will disappear forever, probably into death. If this sounds far-fetched, it seems to me no more preposterous than the firebombing of family planning clinics by pro-life zealots, those lunatics of one idea straight out of a poem by Wallace Stevens. But Marcia Norman isn't a propagandist taking potshots from a pillbox. What she thinks about abortion, as moral issue, as social policy, as personal choice and ambivalence and tragedy, is more complicated and nuanced than any other discussion of the subject that I've seen. And most of what she thinks is put into the mind of Faye Morgan, fortune teller, reader of tarot cards, clairvoyant, a mother herself, and the lover of a policeman who is trying to catch the kidnappers and save the children. Faye reads enough of the future to be fearful, but knowing the future doesn't change it, and the future is full of revenge. And so a suspense story, a detective novel, is grafted onto a love story, and an essay on magic's black and white, and a meditation on mothers and daughters, and a reverie about death that arrives in a black Rolls Royce. Whenever primitive novelist Norman decides to abandon Faye's mind and enter someone else's, she does so abruptly, like changing a diaper. Whenever she chooses to stop and nag us for a couple of pages about adolescence, obsession, politics, fate, sex, or shopping centers, she just sticks in her own opinion, without apology and with the lofty disdain for narrative flow that it took Tolstoy years to learn. This should be awkward and ungainly and even presumptuous. It isn't. Faye's voice, tough, funny, frightened, scrupulous, scandalized, slangy, transcendent, wins us over, bends and staples the heart. Love for her is survival, an exchange of energies, a giving up and a healing, something needy and brave and hung like a Christmas tree with question marks. We suffer the missing children, and they suffer us, and we finally listen to Faye the way we listen to a grown-up Huck Finn, turning like a needle to true north on the moral compass. At a time when most novels seem to want us to feel envious or rotten, The Fortune Teller actually makes us feel that we're smarter and better people for having read it.
Our book critic John Leonard reviews television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, obituary writer Jim Nicholson talks about his unconventional approach to this standard newspaper feature. He shuns the famous, preferring to celebrate the culture and quirks of the average person. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recent reissue of the works of pianist Arthur Schnabel. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg will critique foreign language phrasebooks. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with additional support from the listeners of WHYY-FM.
Fresh Air is produced at WHYY in Philadelphia. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Dougherty is the production assistant. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman and Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. Terry Gross should be back tomorrow. My name is Peter Bryant. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.